Hi, everyone, and welcome to the second edition of the Associate and Affiliate Podcast. I'm Russell Biggin, and I'm pleased to have two people with me today. The first is my regular co-host, who was sick when I talked to Peter, but is on board today, Cricket Europe's Andrew Nixon. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Our other guest this week is John Newton. John is an ESPN Quick Info correspondent for China, the founder of ChinaCricket.org and N4Sports.com. He's the first foreign national on a Chinese regional governing body, the Shanghai Cricket Association, and he tweets at Newton J Cricket. Welcome, John.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on the show today.
It's a pleasure to have you. We're going to get on to Chinese cricket shortly, but first, a very brief roundup of the tournament since the last episode. In Auckland at the East Asia Pacific T20 Division 1 Championship, in a closely fought tournament, the favourites Papua New Guinea defeated Vanuatu in the final by 38 runs to qualify for the World T20 qualifier in Dubai. In the Bahamas, there is still one round to go in the Americas Division 2 T20 qualifiers, but the host nation has already won through to Division 1. And finally, a tournament we'll talk about today, Thailand defeated China by 70 runs in the final of the Asian Cricket Council Women's Championships. The Chinese had won all their group games but collapsed to 5-for-5, chasing 95 and unable to recover. Thailand has now qualified for the Women's World T20 qualifier in Ireland, but both the finalists, along with Nepal and Hong Kong, have qualified for the Asian Games in Incheon, South Korea, next year. So, before we get on to China, I wanted to raise a question about that, because in a couple of those tournaments, we actually saw teams play particularly well, and then actually faced the fact that, in China's case, they had one bad day, and that meant that they basically missed out on qualifying for a tournament. And I think in Vanuatu's case, they're in a position where they had to beat a top 10 associate nation, which is PNG. They're in WCL2, and argue it was actually harder for them to qualify from their region than it will actually be from the qualifiers if they'd made the qualifiers, because at least in the qualifiers you get several opportunities to beat some of those teams. So Andrew, I'll ask you first, does the ICC make it too difficult to move between their divisions or through qualifying with single chances in every single tournament? There's only one team qualifying through.
I think it's a problem that there's no consistency. Some regions have two up, two down. Some regions have one up, one down. Some regions have the top two from Division 2 playing the next Division 1. In Asia, for example, the winner of the ACC Challenge Trophy doesn't play until the ACC Elite Trophy in 2 years' time. So I think the problem is a lack of consistency. If it was consistent, there'd be no problems, but it isn't consistent. Mm. And you have a World Cricket League where if you keep getting promoted, you're playing a tournament every 6 months. If you get relegated from one division, you might not play another tournament for 2 years. So I think there's not necessarily anything wrong with having, say, one up, one down, as long as there's consistency and every promotion and relegation is the same within every region and every global tournament.
Yeah, go on. John, your thoughts?
Yes, sorry.
It was obviously quite disappointing for China to win through, where they won every group game, six games in a row, and then missed out just because they had that warning.
I think just to touch on what Andrew just said, consistency is very important. As you know, in the end of last year, China hosted the Asia Women's Cup, and there was a lot of debate around that tournament, whether they were going to use that as the qualification tournament, which is actually just finished. And basically almost on the morning or, you know, a couple of days before the event actually kicked off, they decided it wouldn't be a qualification tournament. A lot of teams, the associate teams who were coming, almost expected it to be a qualification tournament. So I think what Andrew just said makes a lot of sense, that, you know, people need to be able to prepare and teams need to be able to prepare towards what they're working for in an annual calendar schedule. As you mentioned, China just missed out. And I think, to be honest, in that final, they probably went in as pretty strong favourites based on their previous results. So it's kind of tough. They did come in fifth in the Women's Cup tournament, actually finishing ahead of Nepal and Thailand and Hong Kong. They had that, for example, you know, on the day when the event started off being decided or determined as a qualification tournament, they would have gone through. So I think consistency, like Andrew said, is really important, so that all the associate boards are working towards common goals and dates in their schedule when these big crunch tournaments are happening.
Just to cut in there, going back to the 2005 ITC Trophy, which was the first big global tournament to have regional qualifiers going into it, all the best non-qualifiers from each region then played a repechage tournament, which the winner then went through to the global qualifier. I think that's probably something that should be brought in future for other tournaments as well. I think it was a very good idea. It gives that second chance to teams that have that one bad day in the final.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Totally agree. I think consistency should be rewarded over a one-off game.
All right, let's move on to China. I have a whole bunch of questions, John. Let's start with the most basic, though. What's the history of cricket in China? They've been an affiliate, I think, almost 10 years?
China's been an affiliate of the ICC since 2005. But naturally, cricket has been played in China for, we're going about 170 years now. I would say the oldest cricketing body in China is the Shanghai Cricket Club, which has been playing annual fixtures against the Hong Kong Cricket Club since 1858. And then obviously during the Cultural Revolution and the exodus of foreigners out of China, that ceased for a while. And that was sort of reincarnated or restarted by the foreigners who refounded the Shanghai Cricket Club in 2004. And then effectively, the requirement for the ICC affiliate membership was to have at least four active teams playing cricket in a league, according to ICC rules, which the Shanghai Cricket Club actually helped the Chinese Cricket Association in getting approval for. Because at that time, there was only four or five expat clubs playing cricket in China. That was the platform that started off as. And then the Cricket Association here has obviously grown over the last 8 or 9 years into a much bigger sort of regional body as opposed to just governing a Shanghai Expat Cricket League, which is now, I would say, in terms of cricket development, on the peripheral side of things, and it's more of a platform for the expatriates here to be occupying themselves in the weekends and sometimes getting involved in cricket development. But yeah, that's the general history. It's been played here for, like I said, since 1858. It was the first Shanghai-Hong Kong inter-port, inter-club match.
And in terms of those regions, is it still focused around Shanghai, the number of clubs, or is it right across? Obviously, China's massive, so is it up in the north as well as and the south as well, or is it?
In terms of, I've just touched on expatriate cricket, but in terms of actual expatriate leagues, there are active expatriate leagues in Shanghai, Beijing, and Guangzhou. Shanghai is still the biggest, but then that's very sort of foreign managed and foreign run. But they were sort of the platforms for developing local players initially, but now with the China Cricket Association growing. There is a regional body that has full mandate from the CCA to run regional / provincial grassroots developments and cricket activities, which is the Shanghai Cricket Association. And that's a fully local governing body made up of sort of educators and sports science teachers who've learned the game over the last decade. So there's, in terms of hierarchy, you've got the China Cricket Association based in Beijing, and then you have the Shanghai Cricket Association, which runs all sort of Shanghai grassroots developments, but they also move out into other provinces. And then for the rest of the country, they haven't got big enough yet to actually have regional provincial governing bodies. But another big center where a lot of the national players have come from is in Shenyang, which is sort of in the north part of China near Korea. They have a sports science university with a lot of good players. So then in terms of outside of cricket associations, there are a lot of university clubs spread all over the nation. And then they will get together once a year for sort of a national championship. We'll have universities from, 15, 20 different cities who will actually play in a tournament. And from there, the national sides are selected.
it sounds like cricket amongst the Chinese communities, predominantly in universities at the moment. Are there any clubs made up of native Chinese citizens outside of universities?
I'm sure we'll touch on that later. That's one of the biggest challenges that China, in terms of cricket development, faces, is that right now, barring your 1 or 2% of your outliers, all of them are high school or university or junior school, but they're all students. So at the moment, there are a couple of people who've been to the system. They've graduated from university and they've had to sort of go out and find a job. And what they've done is individuals, they've joined the adult expat clubs and continue playing cricket for the love of the game. But everybody who's playing within the current structure are generally students, because they have the time, less social pressure and family pressure on going out and getting a job as opposed to dedicating a lot of time to cricket. So right now, to answer your question, no. Most of the young Chinese cricketers on development tracks are all junior school, high school, or university students.
Okay.
And what's your relationship with the Chinese Olympic and other kind of broader sports bodies? Are they involved in cricket in China?
Am I involved in cricket? Sorry.
Chinese Olympic Committee and other those types of major sporting bodies, are they involved in cricket, and what's their relationship with bringing that?
A big challenge is if you look at China's track record recently over the last couple of Olympics, they really have dominated, and that's got to do with China views the Olympics as a really good sort of international relations platform, and they view it as a way of sort of within the country garnering national pride. So what they tend to do is the Chinese National sort of Olympic Committee and the sports bodies, they invest as much as they can into Olympic sports programs. So a good example, if you look at our background, is rugby union. The rugby sevens Chinese national team has gone from strength to strength every year because they're getting funding. Naturally, the Cricket Association also falls under the national sports body and under the National Olympic Committee. However, they don't get the funding that the other sports codes do, purely because it's not an Olympic representative sport. So, they obviously consult with them. There is budget allocated to cricket development by the government, but it can't compare to what basketball or football or rugby or a lot of the individual athletic sports get.
This is a problem that's repeated across the cricket-playing world, that Olympic sports get the bulk of the money. So cricket is often left scrambling for the scraps of the funding. So it's not just a Chinese problem, is it?
Yeah. We often talk about it. If you look at the countries who dominate the Olympics, it's countries like the USA and China, and sometimes Russia. But, you know, we all know about USOCA and their development issues. It would probably change the whole international sort of face if China and the USA governments were pumping a lot of money into Olympic cricket development, just based on how they perform at other Olympic sports. So I think a lot of countries would benefit cricket-wise if cricket became an Olympic sport.
It might be a good, actually, place to segue into something I was going to talk about later, but talk about now, which is the Asian Games, which is part of the Olympic movement, were hosted in Guangzhou in 2010, which meant that, amongst other things, you had a purpose-built facility for the cricket, and that meant that there's now a cricket ground, which is, I think, a reasonably high standard. How valuable is that in terms of, first, how valuable was it for promoting the game just to have it in the Asian Games? And have
it did definitely give the Chinese Cricket Association and also the national teams a really big incentive to try and step up in class. Naturally, as hosts, they didn't need to qualify, The women would have qualified anyways. I think the men might have struggled to qualify more not being hosted in China. In terms of what it did for marketing the game, it was difficult from the perspective of TV rights you've got to pay for in China. And as a sports again, we're going to go back to the old problem of funding. They didn't have the budget to get all those big games on television. It was on sort of the 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock national news for a minute or 2 minutes of highlights. But in terms of giving the players something to play for, and actually for the first time, you know, the Chinese national men had to face Pakistan, for example. That would never happen in any other tournament or platform besides an Asian Games where China automatically qualified. So I think from a player perspective, it gave them a lot to play for and an incentive. But in terms of actually being able to spread the game in media and garner interest, again, the problem of budget and not being able to actually have 3 hours dedicated to the Chinese national men team playing against Pakistan, for example, on national TV, that wasn't there. So a lot of people were following the Asian Games because a lot of the mainstream sports were being televised, whereas, you know, sports like cricket weren't being televised live and garnering that national interest that could have been there. But in terms of you also said the purpose-built facility, it is still currently the best cricketing facility in China. And you know, we touched on how well the ladies played in the ACC Championship. They basically spent a 2-month boot camp down there, and you know, before the tournament. So they've got facilities now where they can actually train at, which are world class. Before they were training on tennis courts and, you know, temporary built nets on concrete courts. It's now changed the ability for the coaching staff to actually get the team onto a track that's representative of what cricket's going to be like when they leave the country.
And the cricket event was kept for Incheon. Did you follow that as it was after it? Like, why was that event kept? I know that the Koreans weren't particularly keen because they would have to build that cricket facility, and cricket in Korea is probably at an even lower level than China. But it did you the organisers, the IOC, I think, and the AOC is quite keen because they want to promote cricket within the Indian region, and even though India doesn't well, if they turn up to the Asian Games, at least that's a stepping stone to do that. So what was the feedback when you were actually, while this was going on, that whether or not this was actually a worthwhile thing to have in the Asian Games? Will the Asian Games be a stepping stone to further Olympic involvement?
I think one of the big things is that obviously the Asian Games, while it's still an IOC event, you know, it's naturally, it kind of runs independently of the major Olympic Games. And they work closely with all the sports governing bodies in Asia. And the Asian Cricket Council as a body, who is in charge of associate and affiliate cricket development in Asia, is naturally very keen to see the development of cricket within these countries. So from that perspective, they would definitely buy in for the ACC for it to remain an Asian Games event. We all know about the IOC and the ICC's sort of debate about whether cricket eventually does move into the Olympics. But from an Asian perspective for developing the game, it would make sense that the ACC would definitely support having cricket in the Asian Games. So I think, and I can't speak from a perspective of authority with the Olympic Committee stance, but I think that while a regional governing body, the Asian governing body is backing its inclusion, then I think the Asian Olympic or Asian Games Committee would probably continue to include it.
One other thing I wanted to actually ask as well with regard to getting coverage, and this is one of the things that I've noticed, is that where a smaller nation in the cricket world does quite well because they're a smaller nation, they don't expect their national teams to do well. They can actually garner quite a reasonable amount of coverage if their team has competed at the qualifiers, or even especially if they get in the World Cup, and doing Namibia, for instance, that Ireland probably comes into this as well. Is this, conversely, is this a really big problem for China? Because even if you had, if China had 1% of its population playing cricket, that would be a really big cricket playing nation, but they're still not necessarily going to get a lot of media coverage, because media coverage in China is still only 1% of what's actually going on there. Is this a problem, or is it?
That's definitely one of the problems. It's very difficult to spread an understanding or even a knowledge for the game without media. If you look at some of the sports here that are new and that are developing, I mean, Yao Ming did a lot for the spread of basketball across China. And obviously they had the NBA as a platform to bring basketball into China, which is probably now the most popular team sport in China. But that is one of the issues. I think the other issue is that us people have got, because we know it's a complicated game. And it's not something you can just learn by watching a game of cricket on TV once off. So I think even if there was television coverage of, let's say, hypothetically, a World 2020, people would probably still watch it for 10 minutes and kind of feel, I'm still an alien to this game. I'm still not sure what's going on, and possibly change the channel. So it's not so much about whether the media coverage can garner 1% interest or not. It's more about how long it will take to infiltrate a culture where team sports is actually not that big. And whereas parents, when they look at their children, they want them to become professionals, engineers, accountants, doctors, etc. And getting the current middle class of middle-aged parents to actually decide, well, let me bank on my kid taking up this obscure sport and making a living for our family one day in the future. And that's where the biggest challenge lies. I think the Chinese, as a nation, could probably learn the rules of cricket quite quickly in a general sense. But it's more about how many parents will encourage their young children to spend their time in learning a sport that their parents know nothing about.
That's probably a really good way to segue into talking about development. I know the Chinese Cricket Association set some quite ambitious goals. I'm not sure whether they were just media-driven or whether they were serious, but to have as many as 20,000 players by 2015. The ICCBs at the moment show that they have 450 adult league participants. Please tell me if these are completely off track, because I don't actually know how the ICC gathers these figures. 390 juniors playing, and they've had that pretty much roughly at that level since about 2007. But in the last couple of years, they've had a really rapid growth in the other players category, which is your youth cricket, kind of minor cricket, what we call in Australia, growth. Was there a shift in strategy to push for those participants, and how are you moving those participants into league cricket?
I would say now it's very difficult to define, you know, what is a cricket player, in terms of if you play cricket once a month, are you a cricketer? If you play cricket once a year, are you a cricketer? If you play cricket every week, are you a cricketer? But there has been a shift in strategy from when those figures were originally released to basically trying, which I think is, to be honest, the right track is what they're on now, is to try and introduce it into the school's physical education syllabus. So to give an idea, last year in December, a couple of months ago, the ACC ran a level one coaches course and umpiring course for phys ed teachers in Shanghai, and had about 35 people, men and women, actually participated. Now, again, I think the level of that coach, even though they have a level one certificate, is very different to someone like you or myself, or, you know, Andrew having a level one who grew up with cricket. However, you know, they go back to their schools with a license or a certificate that puts their career in a better perspective. And they are sort of incentivized or in a way almost obligated, because the training was free, to include cricket in their physical education curriculum. So while I can't give you exact figures on how many of those kids are actually playing every week, within the last 2 years in Shanghai alone, 5,000 junior and high school children have been exposed to physical education programs that teach cricket. So that's kind of what the strategy is now, is to get junior school and high school kids to learn at least for a certain period of time in their sports education program within the schooling curriculum to learn how to play cricket and learn the rules and, you know, learn how to play shots X, Y, and Z and learn how to bowl, so that when they see cricket on TV, they understand what it is. Then naturally there's a second stage, which would be the ones who take to it, they might be given free camps, net training for a weekend, whatever. And those are generally the people who've graduated into the national teams and graduated into the university sort of competitive sides, is that they've sort of taken it up and taken an interest in it. And over the last 4 or 5 years have grown up playing cricket regularly. But if you're looking for a number, and this is just within Shanghai, and I know these programs exist in northern China, which sort of includes Beijing, Tianjin, and Dalian. And then these programs also are being run in Guangzhou and Shenzhen. But just in Shanghai alone, in the last 3 to 4 years, 5,000 children have been exposed to cricket education programs.
And you'll then have some of those, how many of those are actually graduating through to universities then? Is that then still only in the hundreds, or is it too early to tell?
It's not too early to tell, because there are some people who've been through the process. There's a couple of national players now, especially in the men's team, who I firmly believe are good enough to be playing club cricket back home. And when I say back home, I grew up in South Africa. They're good enough to be playing club cricket in South Africa or in England or in Australia. But right now there's 3 or 4 of them, and they're young. And that's because they were the guys who got in really early in these programs and loved the game and decided to stay with it. But in terms of numbers, there's about 15 to 20 universities countrywide who have a representative cricket team. So you're looking at, in terms of under 22-year-old locals, you're looking at a good 200 to 300 who've gone on and taken the game up as a hobby or a pastime on a weekly basis, and are playing in inverted commas the national university champs every year. And naturally, hopefully those numbers will grow as the grassroots cricket training grows. And if it works according to plan, more and more 12-year-olds now will be playing cricket when they're 18.
You mentioned having some Chinese players are good enough to play club cricket in South Africa, New Zealand, and England. There was the guy, I can't quite remember his name off the top of my head,
who played
for Cleethorpes in the Lincolnshire League last year. Yes. Are there any more players having to play in England or elsewhere in 2013?
We're currently working on a project to get one of Zhang Shuyao's teammates. His name is Zhang Yufei, an all-rounder. He actually plays in the expatriate club league, and he plays for the national team. He's a batting all rounder. He opens the batting for outside, and he also bowls first change. He's currently 20 years old and at university in Shanghai. And we're busy talking to a couple of clubs in Sydney. So it looks like there's a strong possibility that sort of after the Chinese Northern Hemisphere summer, he might go down towards the end of 2013 and play a full season in Sydney. So again, you know, Zhang Shuyao is a pioneer in the fact that he is the first Chinese cricketer to play a full season of overseas club cricket. But the more guys who can go and do that, and actually it's not so much about facing different bowlers and batting on turf wickets every week. It's more about learning the culture of the game. To actually go and sit in a clubhouse with 6 different grade teams and be in that environment and learn from them, I'm sure Zhang Xuyao could attest to it, and I'm sure I won't be wrong, that he probably learned more about cricket in that one season than what he's learned by playing cricket once a week for 6 months a year in China.
Is there a particular culture of Chinese cricket emerging that's somehow different to other cultures? Obviously, China's a relatively different place, and I think Australian cricket is certainly different to English cricket, and English cricket and Australian cricket is quite different to Indian cricket. So will there be a Chinese cricket stereotype?
I think it's too early to say right now, but what I do think could possibly be sort of evolving out of the whole process over time is, you know, if China does get onto the world stage one day, I think it would probably be predominantly due to their fielding and their bowling. Kind of like, you know, you look at Pakistan and West Indies cricket culture, a lot of people prefer to be a fast bowler over a batsman, whereas you look at a lot of the more traditional cricketing cultures like the old school ones like, you know, Australia, England, everybody wants to bat one drop. Everybody wants to be known as one of the greatest batsmen ever. And a lot of the focal point of the strategy of those teams are around batting. And I think that's more of just a default, because I think China has struggled more on the batting side, both in the men's and women's teams. But in both of those sides, they've had bowlers who have been good enough to, you know, to play at higher levels. So a lot of the focus and the strategy has been around bowling and fielding. So if a brand of Chinese cricket does evolve, I'd predict that it would probably be more of a bowling and fielding sort of live wire team who never stops talking kind of brand, as opposed to having a cricket team with seven formidable batsmen. I think that when they do one day get onto a stage where it would be sort of a brand of Chinese cricket would arrive, that's the kind of cricket I foresee them playing.
Let's move on to the national teams. I missed something particular in development you'd like to touch on. The men's team has struggled considerably more than the women's team. A few years ago, they lost a few games. They lost to Iran by 307 runs. At their most recent tournament, which is the Asian Trophy Challenge in December, I think, they came sixth, but they lost to Iran by only a single wicket. So there is obviously some improvement going on, even though they're still a fair way down the ladder.
For the men's, I think statistics prove obviously that the women have done a lot better relatively than the men have. But there has been improvement. There's a regular sort of a grudge match and it's between Myanmar, Burma. That was actually China's first international victory ever, was when they beat Myanmar a couple of years back. And they're regularly starting to beat Myanmar. They're regularly starting to run teams like Iran and Bahrain and some of the sort of Middle Eastern teams close. But again, I think the biggest problem is it's the batting. They rely on the two guys we've just spoken about. They rely heavily on Zhang Xuyao and Zhang Yufei. And almost when one of or both those guys fail, there's a very big difference in a 2020 game when you're all out for 40 and when you're all out for 140. And generally the difference in that 100 runs I'm talking about is because one of those guys get a 50 and the other guy gets 30. They really need to find a balance or at least six reliable batsmen, which they haven't managed to sort of find yet. Bowling wise and fielding wise, they've always been able to hold their own, but it's normally the batting that's let them down.
Yeah, we're hearing quite a few fireworks at the moment. It is Chinese New Year. I didn't mention that in the podcast. The women have obviously been a lot more competitive. They played the T20 Asian Cup in September and had quite decent results against Sri Lanka and Bangladesh. What was that as an experience for them to play against the, obviously, not quite the really top echelon of women's teams, but certainly the ones that play in the World Cup? What was the feedback from that?
I think one of the major it was kind of a double-edged sword. It was a major achievement, but at the same time a major disappointment, was how close they ran Bangladesh, who were actually on display. If you look at the four major teams who were there, the four full nation sides of India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh. Bangladesh were much almost on par with Pakistan, who ended up being runners-up, and they were definitely stronger than Sri Lanka. You know, it was fantastic to see the women's team run Bangladesh right down to the last over of a 2020 game and really push them. But when you take it in the context of the fact that they dropped three catches in the last five overs, and they probably bowled 10 too many extras, I sort of kind of felt that we missed an opportunity to almost be on CNN. Because I think the day, whether it's a women's team or a men's team, the day China beats a full nation cricket team, it'll probably be on CNN and the BBC and worldwide news. And that was a really big opportunity to make that happen on the day. So they learnt a lot, but again, at the same time, they also learnt that they're capable of really sort of, how would I say it, at the same time, they need to learn not to let the wheels fall off when they get close to these kind of things, because that's the only way you step up in class and get to play on higher platforms, which is similar to what happened against Thailand a week ago, and that's where I think it's a double-edged sword. They got really close to beating Bangladesh, which I'm sure they learned a lot about, but they were also really close on China's biggest cricketing achievement to date. So overall, it was fantastic that China hosted an event like that and gave those players a platform to play against teams like Sri Lanka and Bangladesh. But again, you know, when will that opportunity come around again? Who knows? And that's the problem with associate cricket. You almost get one chance every 4 or 5 years, and if you don't make it happen, it's a long wait until the next opportunity comes around.
Yeah, we see that constantly, I think. Obviously, one of the things I talked with Peter about was that trying to get players to play against that high standard regularly. What are the outlets for China to get to that high standard? Obviously, that was one. Are there other ones coming forward in the future that they might be able to tack onto, or is it they're going to struggle for the next couple of years to actually find that level to play against until obviously the next tournament?
I think you know, we've mentioned it a couple of times, the game against Thailand a couple of weeks ago. For someone involved in the cricket administration here, and I was constantly on the phone to my Chinese colleagues almost every over during that final, that was a very, very big disappointment for Thailand. For China. I mean, well played, Thailand. They deserve to win that game. In terms of an opportunity, a lot have been invested into that. A lot have been invested into the current squad on the women's team, the women's squad that spent 2 months down there in a hotel in Guangzhou, training every day with coaching staff. And there wasn't an assumption or an expectation to win, but there was a confidence that they really stood a good chance of actually getting to the final qualifier in Ireland. And as you know, there are going to be countries like Zimbabwe there, and it would have definitely put China on the highest platform ever that it would have played cricket at. And just one or two victories there might have actually kind of garnered some sort of sponsorship interest or something to make Chinese cricket stand out as a potential beacon of light for years to come. So, you know, when we talk about the disappointments and the missed opportunity, that was probably the biggest one recently, which is, it still kind of hurts. And unfortunately, because the ladies missed that, you know, now in August, Thailand will go to Ireland and play there. and everything sort of takes a back seat. So I would expect the next best opportunity would probably be in 2 years' time when they play again for the next qualifier, because obviously the World 2020 Championships are held every 2 years. So there'll be another tournament in 2 years' time. But again, the risk is, which we spoke about earlier, they're all students. A lot of this team will most likely have already graduated from university, possibly had to move on from cricket because they've had to go and find jobs and earn a living. It might be a totally different squad who hasn't benefited from this experience, and they have to go in again, start from fresh, and hope to win that tournament. So it's very difficult to create that continuity when it's not professional.
I was going to ask about professionalism because you mentioned that they spend a couple of months training. They're training within the context of their university studies then, as in it's a summer camp. Is that how that operates?
Yeah. As I said, they're all university students. A lot of them, which is a really good incentive or initiative by the Chinese Cricket Association, a lot of them get scholarships at the university. So if they get identified at, say, 18 as a national player, they will generally get into a university on a full scholarship with, how would I say, quite a lot of freedom in terms of the ability to attend summer camps, the ability to travel for a month or a couple of weeks on an Asian cricket tournament. So, you know, to put things in perspective, the Chinese academic calendar doesn't work around the same as ours. So all those guys and girls who've just been in Thailand for those last two tournaments, it was still the academic year, and they missed out 2 weeks of academics. But because of the programs they're on, they're allowed to miss that and then get sort of sports credits based on that. So it's all tied into the university education system, and those universities give Cricket Association and the players the leeway to attend when they can, and then obviously to be playing cricket for their country when they need to be.
That's definitely a promising system then to have in place. At least, obviously, you have the problem that once they graduate, they're out of it. But is there likely to, obviously, do you need to actually start winning those tournaments then to get that next step where they graduate out into a different type of sports program, a government sports program where they can be professional or semi-professional out of there? Is that the long-term goal?
I think that would definitely be a long-term goal. I think, to be honest, the government probably would have funded, and it obviously would have been channeled in the direction of women's cricket. But let's just say China's women had managed to qualify last week. There would have been additional funding for the next event, which would have probably meant, you know, that squad could have trained a lot more. A lot would have been invested into them to actually try and qualify for the end goal, which would be in the World Cup, which would have been phenomenal for Chinese cricket. But again, you know, if you look at it, let's take the men, for example, who are much further from qualifying for 2020 World Cups than what the women are. Had the men not come sixth in the last Asian Championship, had they come fourth, or even if they had won, they probably would have gone through as the fifth Asian team to a World Cup qualifier. But again, going right back to the beginning of this conversation, without the promise or the dangling carrot of having a Chinese national team on global television in an Olympic event or a World Cup event, you know, professionalism is very far away, because essentially the government's going to need to fund those professionals initially. Adidas aren't going to put sponsorship into Chinese cricket like they do to English cricket. And Nike aren't going to, sponsor Team India and China. So a lot of that professionalism will come from government budgeting. And the government would look at it as a long-term investment, that is this team going to be on a national stage, flying the Chinese banner in an international, globally recognized tournament, i.e. the Olympics or the World Cup.
And if we look at the schedule for the Asian Cricket Council tournaments. There's no tournament for the Chinese men this year. I assume their next tournament would be towards the end of 2014 with the ACC Challenge Trophy. So that's a long time to go without any cricket and without any exposure for any potential sponsors.
Well, that's the biggest, that's really a big dilemma. And that's why we've obviously identified trying to send WFA to Australia this year, because effectively this group of boys, when I say boys, it's because some of them are 18, but you know, they range between 18 and 22. You know, this group of guys, they've tried to groom them. They needed to finish, I think, top three to go through to the next sort of stage of tournaments that would happen this year. They finished sixth, as we mentioned earlier. And now they're sort of going to be in limbo. It really puts a spanner in the works for the development of that core group of players. And in essence, you know, what are they playing for? They've got, like you said, 2 years of inactivity. So some of them will be active in the Expat Cricket League, which they'll play in regularly throughout the Chinese summer. But it's a bit of a consolation prize when you think about the fact that in December they were playing for their nation, and they might not be able to do it again for 2 years.
The expat leagues, or is there a women's expat league as well, or is there some way for the women to continue playing cricket after the they finish university?
There isn't a women's expat league, but the men's expat league in Shanghai, you know, as from my river, it's actually very big. There are three divisions, and there are 17 teams across those three divisions. So the first division plays 40 over cricket, the second division plays 30 over cricket, and the third division plays 20/20. And there's actually, you know, a good example is the former women's national captain, and I think to date she's still China's most capped women's cricketer. But naturally, she's now going on 25. She had to go and, you know, she graduated from university. She works for a Singaporean company in Shanghai. And just for the love of the game, she didn't want to quit. So she plays in the third division of the men's league because she's good enough to. But again, for her, it's purely a social thing. She comes on a Sunday and she plays cricket because it's something she doesn't want to give up just yet. But she's not part of the official system where she can train with the national ladies team, go down to the Guangzhou 2 month sort of intensive national camp because she has a job. So again, yeah, there is room and space for women to carry on playing, but how would I say, it's sort of on the peripherals of the actual national team structures and national development system.
Another question about women's cricket. One of the reasons I think women's cricket in East Asia, this is a slightly more general question as well, that one of the things we've seen, particularly in football and hockey, is that East Asian nations have become competitive quite quickly in those sports. Obviously, they're Olympic sports, but because women's sport is has a lower playing base, it's actually easy to bridge that gap between the elite teams and the developing teams, and we've seen East Asian nations come quickly. So women's cricket, presumably cricket is going to be much more likely to be a sport that the women do well in China more quickly, and is it should be a focus?
I think naturally China would love their men to perform better, but you're right. It has been something that you can even see in field hockey. You know, China have beaten Pakistan, who are considered a very strong hockey nation. And in cricket, they have made progress that sort of totally. If you have to graph the progress of women's cricket versus men's cricket, they're totally almost opposite each other. They almost mirror each other on opposite sides of the graph. I think a lot of it has to do with And we're getting into more sort of intangible cultural things. A lot of it has to do with Chinese culture. And obviously it's changing now, and it's changed over the last, say, decade. But there's always been a much stronger emphasis on am as an individual in Chinese culture. A lot of young Chinese boys are brought up sort of with a very self-centered upbringing, with two parents and both sets of grandparents focusing only on them because they are viewed as the future breadwinner of their family. Girls have always been brought up to believe that they will be married off to someone else's family later. So girls have just grown up being, in terms of the attention they've got, they've always grown up as sort of team players and grown up as people who are givers and people who are very selfless. Not in a bad way, in a more generous way. Whereas men are a lot sort of, they need to sort of be the achiever. So I don't think it's a coincidence that you look at how the women's rugby sevens team have actually done a lot better on the Asian rugby sevens circuit than the men have. The hockey team has done better. The cricket team has done better. And I think it's just got to do with the fact that girls are a lot more accepting of saying, well, my role is, hypothetically, I'm a spin bowler, but I'm going to bat 11. And they'll understand that it's their role in the team, in which is a small society, if you want to put it that way. Whereas it's more difficult to explain to sort of a young Chinese guy who's been taught all his life that he is the most important cog in his family's wheel for the future, that he's a good spin bowler, but he has to bat number 11. What you're telling him is that you've got one skill, but the other skill you're worst at. And that's why China does really well on the men's side as an individual sport, because then that guy is sort of incentivized to win on his own. And I think it's not just about cricket. It's about why most of the women's teams have done better than the men's teams, just based on a general social strata within China. And it's old culture. It's changing now. It's been changing over the last 10 years. But again, you know, the girls who play it now, they're on average 20. So for the first 10 years of their life, they were brought up in what was a very old school system where everybody wanted a son and not a daughter, and the daughters learned to cooperate with whoever they were married to, whichever family they were married into, and whichever job or boss male boss they worked for. So I think it's very representative of the culture of China. Not so much about their athletic abilities. I think it's more of a psychological thing.
I'm pretty much out of questions, I think. Andrew, do you have any?
No. More questions for me. I think John's covered quite a lot for us. It's a great chat.
Well, we might. Sorry, go, John.
I can throw in something else if you're interested, because yes. I was asked this by someone else the other day. That there's been a lot of talk about, China promised to be in the 2020 World Cup or be a test nation by 2020 and all those things. And someone asked me why does it not look like they're going to get there? And what does China need to be able to become the cricket power that the hype and the ICC have been saying that they hope for one day? And to me, it's not the athletic ability. And it's not so much media or anything like that. It's got to do with we come from cricketing backgrounds, and I played, and I still play club cricket, but I played cricket from 6 years old until 22-year-old in South Africa. And because cricket is the complicated game that it is, and the psychologically taxing game that it is, I think China will only get onto a level that we've been discussing this whole chat when there is almost a generation or two of those sort of silver-haired guys at clubs who come down in their blazers and ties and create a culture where you can sit down at next to a clubhouse and get advice from a guy who's got 20 years or 30 years of cricket knowledge behind him, because it is a very, very complicated game, and you can't just learn how to play cricket in 2 years. You can learn all the rules in 2 years, but captaincy in cricket is probably one of the most complicated sporting jobs in the world, as opposed to perhaps different team sports. And that's, I think, where even the players I mentioned to you earlier, these really good guys, they don't know in a match situation when it's time to block it out or when it's time to accelerate or field placements. And that's got nothing to do with the textbook. It's got to do with learning how to read the game and other players. And that comes from potentially 20 years of playing the game, from when you're 6 years old until when you're 26. And that's where I think the gap is, where I think a lot of the local Chinese cricket fraternity frustration has also come is, you know, we spent years, nearly a decade, investing in these guys and trying to get them to play regularly, and they know all the rules and they know all the shots out of the textbook. And these guys can't play the shots. But it's more about creating a culture of one or two generations of advice and experience on not how to play the game physically, and how to read the game, and how to sort of strategize for it. And a lot of that creativity is stifled by the how would I say it, the political terrain of Chinese culture. And again, you know, a government system where individual leadership is not encouraged and individual creativity is not encouraged. And that's why, you know, it's difficult to foresee a Steve Waugh, a Graham Smith, a Michael Vaughan all of a sudden appearing with that sort of creative thinking under the current system. And because cricket is such a strategic psychological game, I can see them getting there quicker in rugby or football. But in cricket, I think it might take a little bit longer. Anyways, that was just an extra thing I wanted to throw in there, because I think it's got a lot to do with the cultural terrain.
It's certainly an interesting topic. Thanks for joining us, John, and thank you, Andrew. Hopefully China will progress, and hopefully we'll see at least one of their teams on the international stage in the next few years.
It would be fantastic.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Russ. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.